Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Remember getting this curious notification on your phone in 2016? After dark, President Obama spends hours alone. Time, he says, is essential to think, write, and have a snack. Exactly 7 almonds. That was one of the New York Times' most successful push notifications of 2016, meaning many of you probably swiped through the notification to read the source article. It's an example, says the Times, of the perfect push notification, concise with intriguing detail. Well, my next guests say that in the past year, the nature and tenor of push alerts have changed. With the torrent of news, push alerts have become something of a yardstick by which to measure the relevance and gravity of a news item. So with me now are Julia Turner, editor-in-chief of Slate, Stephen Sostanovich, fellow for Russian and Eurasian Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and professor of international diplomacy at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. He writes in Slate about Russia-related push alerts. And Dahlia Lithwick, who covers courts and the law for Slate. She also hosts the podcast Amicus. They all participated in writing the recent feature for Slate called A Year in Push Alerts. Welcome, all of you, back to WNYC. Hi there. So, Julia, why look back over the past year in Push Alerts?
Well, I think this has been an eventful year to look back on in a number of ways. But one thing that struck us was not so much that the push alert has changed over the past year, but that the nature of the news has changed. And so the role that the push alert plays in alerting us to the onslaught of surprising and startling things happening in our country and in the world has changed. And we thought it would be interesting to look both at how those alerts are made and sent out and what it's like to receive them.
And you write, something happened to the news this year. It wasn't only Trump. It was a convergence of Trump and technology and the media landscape, with the invigorated news giants and hungry digital outlets duking it out for our bloodshot eyeballs. Ha!
That's our executive editor, Allison Benedict, wrote that in our package.
Right.
But yes, we wrote that.
And so you're saying push alerts are a symptom of the same condition that caused our country to elect Trump?
I'm not sure I'd go as far as to say they're a symptom. I think that's an interesting subject for debate. I think the world went topsy-turvy a year ago when we elected Trump, and that push alerts have both kept us in a state of kind of adrenaline response to the news that is both exhausting and terrifying and also possibly warranted given what's happening in the world.
Listeners, we definitely want your phone calls on this. What's your relationship to push alerts? Is there a push alert you particularly remember from this past year? Did it make you gasp or stop in your tracks? What was it? Where were you? What makes you, in general, swipe through a push alert that you get on your phone and actually go look at the articles? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Dahlia, you looked at push alerts and the law?
That's right.
So what were you looking for?
Well, I was looking for, for one thing, the Friday night, every Friday night, just when you were shutting down and trying to cook dinner, there was something Russia-related, something Rod Rosenstein-related. There was the, Jim Comey. So I think that for us, particularly I think in the law, who followed the rhythms of the courts in this country, which meant that at 5 p.m. on Friday, the week was over until 9 a.m. Monday morning. And that has been completely topsy-turvy now. And now what we see is that if you're covering a legal story, probably, especially I would say the Russia investigation, that all the good stuff is going to happen at Friday night at 5 o'clock, and that you're going to find that out first and foremost on your phone by way of a push alert. So if you were, I think, tried to organize your life around the law and the courts, this was the year when weekends died.
And so, listeners, as you call in, you can also tell us for which news organizations have you signed up for their push alerts? Do you have just one or two on your phone? Do you go whole hog and maybe you have six or eight or 10? Do you sign up for push alerts routinely from news organizations you read? How do you decide on this for yourself? 212-433-WNYC. And if you've thought about it, who does a good job and who is cluttering your phone with extraneous alerts that make you roll your eyes? 212-433-9692. And Steve, you look back at the Washington Post and New York Times, Russia-related push alerts in particular. Aside from reading a conspiratorial thriller about 140 characters at a time, what did you learn from the endeavor?
Well, you know, one of the issues that I think worth noticing here, something we haven't mentioned so far, and that is not the media as the primary actor, you know, interrupting your Friday night dinner, Dahlia, but other actors who set the tempo of the stories. And I would say that what comes through in a year of push alerts is that it's been the institutions of the American system that have set the tempo of the news. The extraordinary leaking that happened from inside the intelligence agencies, the FBI, the Congress, even the White House, pushing information out there to the media because they didn't want Trump to get away with his Russia story. And that has really been the most important factor in the entire drama surrounding Russia, is Trump's inability to keep the institutions that he nominally controls from rising up against him and offering their point of view.
But you're right, and you were kind of just saying this, reading the alerts and tracking the waves of coverage makes very clear that the media never had the lead role in the Russia story. And yet I'll bet a lot of our listeners think, wait, the media has really had the lead role in the Russia story. The New York Times and Washington Post in particular have so enhanced their reputations, you know, for aggressive reporting on this.
They have aggressive reporting in a sense, but you know, my formula for this is that they didn't go looking for this story. It came looking for them. You only had to be a reporter with a telephone to be able to cover this story, because all kinds of people were calling you to say, let me tell you what outrageous thing just went on today. You know, what President Trump said to the Russian foreign minister and ambassador in the Oval Office about Jim Comey. This was a kind of hemorrhage of information from inside the government that drove the president totally nuts and that he couldn't control. But it wasn't really investigative reporting that produced it. It was an unhappiness on the part of institutions that felt they shouldn't be politicized, that an unhappiness that the president was actually keeping them from doing their jobs.
And you pull out, for example, the Washington Post's push alert of May 11th. Before Comey's firing, Trump's animus toward the FBI director boiled over into fury, according to 31 officials' accounts. Why are you laughing?
Because I can't remember a time where I ever saw a news organization bragging that it had 31 sources for some juicy detail. I mean, the thing about this is that it used to be that investigative reporters would dig and dig, and they'd come up with two sources, the old Woodward Bernstein rule. This time you had people from all over the government giving the media information about what was going on, and so you ended up with with a push alert referring to 31 confirmations.
Yeah, but Julia, they had to work for those 31, presumably, didn't they? I mean, I've signed up for the Washington Post push alerts, and I've seen, if I don't remember that one in particular, other ones like it from the Post and other news organizations. And they come across, to my eye, with a fair bit of gravity. Because if Trump is out there denying what appears to everyone else to be reality, which has been happening all year, when I see something like, before Comey's firing, Trump's animus toward the FBI director boiled over into fury, according to 31 officials' accounts. Well, probably one or two or three officials contacted the Washington Post, and then they went out and reported on how universal a perception this was. Or what am I missing?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, I'm not sure. I agree that all of these stories just fell in the laps of the Washington Post and the New York Times. It takes a ton of work to pin things down and get them on the record. And if you can get 31 people to say them on the record, that's better than if you can get two. And, you know, I think the point here is that the underlying news conditions of the year are such that the way we cover the news and the way we respond to it has changed. So that affects what kinds of sourcing there are in investigative stories, and it affects what it means to get push alerts every day. I mean, I think, you know, one thing that we strove to do in putting together the big interactive that shows you in order every single push alert the New York Times sent in the first year of Trump's presidency or in the year since Trump's election is you get a sense of just how assaultive the news was. Mm-hmm. You can see the alerts pop up and almost feel like they're barraging you, attacking you. You remember entire news flaps that you may have forgotten about because they've been superseded by subsequent insane-seeming news events that you would never have anticipated in previous administrations. And just looking back on the sheer scope and rhythm of the type of breaking news that we've had this year is in and of itself an interesting reflection. I also think one thing that we all thought about as we were putting this together is what do you do with the news when you get it, right? You know, I think one line in the piece suggests that in general, you know, over the past decades, being the sort of person who keeps up on the news suggests that you are a civic-minded individual who's keeping track of everything that's going on in the world, you know, so as to best wield your power as a citizen and, you know, raise your voice to your representatives and, you know, vote according to all of the things you've gleaned from your careful news reading over the course of the year. In this particular moment, it can be hard to know what to do with all of the news that reaches you. And the push alert is a particularly intimate way of that news reaching you. Obviously, your listeners to this right now probably have the radio on in their cars or their kitchens and are hearing the news as kind of an ambient bit of their audio soundscape. You know, many of us are used to getting email newsletters or flipping over the newspaper, but this sort of sense that the news is blipping up at you in the same format that you get the text message from your sister, it's a different way to get news delivered to you right at a moment when news is unlike it's been in any time I can remember.
Absolutely. And listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about push alerts. And for those of you, and there are some of you, who don't know what a push alert is, a push alert is something that appears on your phone from a news organization without you actually going to their site or going to their app, because you've signed up for New York Times or Washington Post or other push alerts so that their judgment about what deserves to just show up on your phone, and if you've got your sound on, you know, give you a little beep-beep to tell you that there's another push alert there. That's what we're talking about, and that's a way that more and more people are consuming news and being led to longer news articles, for those of you who don't know what a push alert is. And as you just heard from Julia Turner, editor-in-chief of Slate, they put together this whole feature on the last year in push alerts, including every single Trump-related push alert from the New York Times. So we're talking to Julia. And
all of them, not just the Trump ones.
Oh, all of the New York Times push alerts. I apologize. So to Julia and Steve Sestanovich, who writes about Russia-related push alerts in the Slate package, and Dahlia Lithwick, who covers courts and the law for Slate. And let's take a phone call. Joseph in Elizabeth, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joseph.
How are you doing, Brian? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I kind of wanted to just say how the push alerts, just to piggyback on what the guest was saying, that it kind of just brings the story to you even when you don't really want to kind of have it at the time. So I'll kind of, there have been instances where I'm hanging out with friends and then all of a sudden we all kind of get the alert that there was another shooting, or same thing with what happened over Halloween with the incident in New York. And it kind of just brings down the mood at the time, and then everybody just kind of starts really looking into what was going on, and it's just kind of out of our control now. It's just kind of happens, and then we just have to kind of start looking more and more and more.
Has it made you
tragic?
Joseph, has it made you think of disabling push alerts? For example, we just got a tweet from a listener that says, disabling push alerts for news was a breath of fresh air for me. Some of the pushes aren't banner headline quality, So if you're feeling assaulted by, you know, really horrible news and you can't control when you consume it, have you actually disabled push notifications?
Well, it's kind of difficult for, because especially since from Elizabeth, we were all trapped with the Rahimi bombing because he was from Elizabeth.
Yep.
So a lot of us kind of want to always kind of keep up to date, especially when it comes to things like that, because it just seems more tense the way things have been, and it's almost like you have to kind of keep an eye out. You just can't help it. It's almost like an addiction.
Joseph, thank you so much. Dahlia, do you want to comment on this? Because, you know, in the realm of courts and the law, come these things that are going to wind up in arrests and trials like these horrible shootings.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you're hearing is this really complicated mental space we've all gotten into, where we really feel that it's incumbent upon us, it's the responsible thing to do, is to keep on top of this, right? The one thing we were warned by all the authoritarianism experts after the election was, don't normalize, you know, register each TikTok as something profound and watch the world changing so that you can bear witness to change. And I think, you know, what your caller is expressing, what you're hearing is the work of doing that, the work of saying, okay, I will be the sort of person who is monitoring the TikTok, is also, you know, opening the door to a certain kind of relentless assault. And the very fact, it's so interesting that as we're talking, we're all going, oh, I remember that Jim Comey push alert. You know, oh, wait, what? That happened with Arpaio? We can't even remember push alerts from a week ago. And so there's a weird paradox here, which is as we're trying so hard to stay on top of things, we're forgetting things or no longer registering things that were extraordinary that happened only 6 weeks ago.
Renato in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Renato.
How's it going?
Good.
Love the show, by the way.
Thank you.
So I had a comment just regarding push notifications in general. About a year ago, I was actually working as a butcher during the election, et cetera, and I had been working under Trump supporters, and I really did find some level of respect to them. And then all of a sudden, as soon as all this barrage of news starts happening, it becomes almost a civic pulse. It led me to start really thinking about the relationships I was having, and I wanted to kind of get out of that idea of just being able to fall asleep with the world going on as it is. And so a year after that, after Trump got elected, I'm no longer a butcher. I'm working at Tesla. And I feel like having a system where every day I wake up to a new kind of piece of information that lets me know I still have an impact, that's important. I think a journalist kind of show us every day we can have an impact. And you can actually change the world by telling the truth.
So you're saying the push alerts and the way they're transmitted somehow replicate what you feel should be the urgency that citizens are feeling in this time of Donald Trump.
Exactly. I think to some degree, the speed at which information is transferred between us now has gone from getting a letter in the mail every couple of weeks to every single second we're pounded with more information. I think that to some degree, we need to catch up to the actions that need to be taken. You know, I think before 2016, we fell asleep at the wheel with our own democracy.
By the way, you get our Diverse Resume of the Day award if you work for a butcher shop and Tesla. So thank you very much for your call. Julia, that's an interesting take that I hadn't thought of before, but maybe he's right, you know, that this is a time that many people do feel urgent, and that arguably people should feel urgent about developments in the news. And so the push alerts are appropriate and, to him, satisfying.
Yeah, I mean, I think it circles back to Dahlia's point as well, that it's a way of reminding you that even though surprising and startling things happen sometimes every day in this news environment, it's still worth being startled and surprised by them. It's still worth having a little buzz in your pocket that says, actually, you should stop what you're doing and take note of the fact that this or that administration official has been accused of this or that scandalous thing. You know, it can feel like an act of civic responsibility to be paying attention. On the other hand, I do think part of what makes people feel so exhausted at the end of this year is that, of course, merely paying attention can also make you feel powerless, because what can you do? What can any one person do about the various things that they've read about, whether it's a mass shooting or a terror attack, or the latest from our president? And, you know, obviously many people over the past year have converted concern into action in various ways, but there can be that kind of, you know, deadening too much time looking at your phone feeling that you can get from anything you do on your phone, that you can also get, I think, being on the receiving end of these news alerts where you feel like, oh my gosh, there's so much input, and yet I'm just still sitting here looking at the small device.
And Dahlia, you wrote, the challenge for me as a reporter in the first months of the Trump era was to try to make the case that language still had meaning, that presidential tweets held the force of law, and that truth was still knowable. Every day was a graduate level class in ontology. Do you want to expand on that?
Well, I think that the point I had been making as a journalist was that the same values we have in the law, you know, that there are fixed meanings to language, that there is true and that there is false, those are the values we actually have in journalism. And that, ironically, the fights that I'm having on both fronts, the sort of battles you do every day, are trying to answer this nihilistic, well, maybe nothing is true, maybe if anyone believes something, it's just true, maybe everything is hashtag fake news. That's leaching into, I think, the conversation we're now having in the courts. And so I think what I was trying to say in that piece was, this is destabilizing both to the conversation around the rule of law and these funny, strange meta questions about whether when the president tweets about something, it should have the force of law. That conversation is now a conversation we're having both about law and journalism. And these are almost philosophy grade class discussions. I mean, this is not what journalists thought they would be doing, is saying, like, true is true, true is true. People, true is true. That is not where we thought we'd be as journalists, and it's not where we thought we'd be as lawyers.
Jesse in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, Brian. How are you? Great show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to share that last spring my mother was visiting, and she was visiting me, my two-year-old, and my wife, and the whole weekend, you know, she kept being interrupted by her phone and the news, her push alerts, and eventually I was, like, pleading with her to, like, disable her news alerts, and she couldn't imagine that. She refused. But we compromised, and I changed her CNN alerts to New York Times alerts, which I thought was a big upgrade, because it cut out a lot of the sort of less meaningful news alerts she was getting. Mm. And it was just I think it was a slight improvement over where she was. It was really getting in the way of our visit, our time together.
So your impression was that CNN push alerts are more trivial, more of the time than New York Times ones?
Yes, definitely. It includes, like, a lot of sort of, like, violent crime stuff happening in different places and celebrity news and things that, like, she definitely did not need to be interrupted.
Cable TV.
You know, even as an avid news reader.
Cable TV. Come to push alerts. Jesse, thank you. I'm curious, Steve Sestanovich, did you compare CNN versus New York Times Russia push alerts, or let's say the cable channels generally versus the main national newspapers generally?
I didn't, but I'm sure that what Jesse says is right, that you get a more sensationalized food fight treatment of the news kind of across the political spectrum, whatever network or channel you're listening to. My own experience being on those channels was you know, it was kind of hopeless because you were always on with five different people and everybody was screaming, you know, their point of view. And you found it, I found it always hard to imagine how anybody watching these things would find it valuable. But I don't know about the push alerts themselves. If I could add one other thing, though, about this, because I think this theme of, you know, individual empowerment versus powerlessness is definitely central to the way the whole last year has felt. And Dahlia writes in her terrific piece about a shaken faith in institutions. The one thing, as I kind of suggested earlier, that comes out from reading all the Russia push alerts is that in some ways our institutions still are working, because Trump has really been hemmed in by the institutions of our national security bureaucracy and the Congress and so forth, so that this is an issue where it actually hasn't been entirely possible to say true is false and that meanings are completely irrelevant. You know, institutions have reasserted themselves in a way that even as we feel terrible about push alerts, it's kind of encouraging.
And talking about CNN push alerts, I guess this one comes from your article. It's, one of my producers put it in front of me, a CNN push alert about the shooting in Las Vegas that read, "Trump called the massacre in Las Vegas pure evil, but what is evil? And what, if anything, can we do about it?" And then people on Twitter joked that CNN had hired Friedrich Nietzsche as their new push alert editor. Alina on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alina.
Hi. Thank you so much for your show. I was just wondering, while you were having this discussion, about how much editorial sort of decision goes into what gets, literally, who pushes the button or what gets transmitted. Is there a lot of discussion beforehand? And also, if there's any sort of unknown advertising link in terms of linkage to articles once you click on them.
Julia?
There's a great piece in the package by Will Arimus, our tech writer, who spoke to the push alert teams at both The Post and The Times. And there's a ton of debate that goes into these, and they are pure editorial operations without advertising links, I believe. The Post has taken a pure kind of hard news approach and are really pushing primarily breaking and investigative news, whereas The Times has taken a broader lifestyle approach and will still push features, stories like that Seven Almond post. They do still sometimes include stories like that in addition to the big breaking news stories. One thing I found striking in looking at our interactive and seeing the whole year in one place is that when you have a news year like the one we've just had, the fact that the New York Times pushes news of every celebrity death begins to seem a little strange. Like, the significance of the deaths of people who starred on television shows in the 1960s and 70s begins to seem way overstated in the news landscape if you only look at the push alerts of the past year. Obviously, things that people want to commemorate and sometimes communally, and maybe that's why they're pushed, but it's sort of an oddity if you look at that array of pushes.
2017 in news organization push alerts, according to Julia Turner, editor-in-chief of Slate, Dahlia Lithwick, who covers courts and the law for Slate, and Stephen Sestanovich, who is a fellow for Russian and Eurasian Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and professor of international diplomacy at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. He writes about Russia-related push alerts this year in the package of articles that Slate has now. Thank you all so much for coming on and talking about them with us.